Welcome to the Future Ready Today podcast. I'm Andy Woods, an ex-science teacher and now a product manager at Pearson. Today I'm speaking with David Price. David consults and advises corporations, governments and education leaders on preparing for future shifts in work in our digitally connected world. We cover a wealth of topics in this episode, from how to create a culture of innovation and creativity in the workplace to how schools can prepare today's learners for the future. Keep listening to the end as David also reveals something you probably didn't know about the humble post-it note. Hello and welcome. I'm with David Price this afternoon on the podcast, and he is an expert in engagement, both in work and in the school environment. And I wanted to start off to kind of refer to something on your website, David, which talks about the level of engagement in work at 13% and the level of engagement of 30% of students in school. In terms of your definition of engagement, what is that measured on? What do you think, or what kind of questions you are asking people in order to determine their level of engagement?
Well, that's a great opening question, that, Andy, because that is part of the problem. It seems to me that if we look at it, I think it's less controversial in terms of the workplace, although pretty shocking when you consider on average. I mean, surveys vary, but it's usually between about 13 as the worst case and about 30% as the best case scenario levels of employee engagement. But in the school context, or I should say education context, because that also includes colleges, I think there's an issue around how we define engagement and how we measure it. And I spent a lot of time looking into this about 10, 12 years ago when I led a program which was essentially trying to address some of the issues around student engagement. And what we found was that predominantly the way in which engagement has been defined is really around compliance. You know, does the student behave themselves in class? Do they submit their work on time? Do they carry out their homework? Are they well behaved? So I don't think that gets to the heart of certainly what employers are looking for in terms of an engaged employee. So I think there are some issues around that.
And do you think, in terms of engagement, is there any data you've come across in terms of, so if we're talking about work, has engagement in work kind of been declining over the last 20 years, you'd say, or is it the same as it's been? Is there any kind of patterns within that you've seen in your work?
Yeah, well, the sort of barometer for that is the Gallup the Employee Engagement Survey, which they carry out every year, but they've been doing it for about 20 years, and it has gradually declined over the years. It's actually taken a bit of a step up since those figures that I talked about were quoted in my book. So it's higher than 13%, but it's still pretty low. I think the one could argue that there's been a drop off in autonomy in the workplace, and as more and more workers are working to a script, even in the higher educated professions. So that's clearly had an impact on engagement. And then there's the other big factor, I think, is how leaders choose to kind of motivate and reward their staff.
So in terms of your kind of going back to that idea of engagement thinking about what kind of things companies can do or future companies can do in terms of making their work engaging, do you think that is the biggest factor? Do you think autonomous or working practices is the biggest thing that companies could do to help with their engagement levels?
Well, yes. And the irony is that when times are hard, and boy, are we in a period of hard times right now, what I found in my research was that employers tend not to pay a great deal of attention to employee engagement. You know, they take the view, well, you're lucky to have a job, so, you know, you need to be engaged. And I'm not really interested one way or the other whether you are, just do the job. Whereas it becomes a premium in the new knowledge economy sector in terms of attracting talent. The point I was trying to make in my previous book, Open, was to say, actually, the reverse of that should be the case if you think that through. When times are hard, you really need your staff to be engaged because innovation and new ideas is at an absolute premium.
And what do you think stops companies kind of taking this approach? Do you think that is just historical within certain types of companies? What is it? What's the barrier you think that they have got to trying to fit this into their industry? Is it a particular problem in certain industries, or do you see it across the board, you know, in retail, in, you know, manufacturing? Do you see it in more in one sector than another?
I think you see it less. It's less of a problem in flatter, more new knowledge economy organizations. Startups typically have very high levels of engagement. You know, something like Google has for a long time now had 94-95% levels of engagement. On the other hand, one of the books that companies that I've case studied in the new book, WD-40, I mean, it's a pretty unglamorous product. Everybody's got a can of it underneath the fridge, underneath the sink, rather. And what they found there is that the levels of engagement are extraordinarily high. They're about 98%. And that's about the leadership of that organization and the learning which takes place. One of the things that surprised me when I was doing my research over the last 5 to 6 years is that employers talk about the need for learning, and you know, they call themselves learning organizations, but about 95% of them don't actually do anything to reinforce that and to make that a priority. So I think when you talk about what's the kind of secret sauce of employee engagement, I think feeling that you're making daily progress or a sense of personal mastery in meaningful work, and I think that's really important, particularly in the future, and having a degree of autonomy, for me, they are three of the keys.
So when you're talking about, so for, you used the example of WD-40, and to me, my perception is, yeah, everyone's got a can of it in the garage or what have you, and it's used for many different uses. But in that company, as an example, when you're thinking about single products, how do they approach the idea of autonomous learning? When to my eyes, I think, oh, well, if they're making this product, are they going to different sectors within the business and saying, do you want to work, you know, find out how, you know, the caps in this work, or do you want to find that work with the design team? Or is it wider than that, as in, I realize you're quite into, you know, technology, would you like training on computer programming? Because maybe that would help our business. And they're kind of exploring wider training needs and interests of the employees. Or is it very much focused in on the product and the profit of that company and knowing bits and pieces about the business? How do they approach that?
Well, it is a fascinating example, because for many years, WD-40 only had one product, and that was the can that we all know and are familiar with. And it was making them a ton of money. So there was actually very little incentive to innovate. Then Gary Ridge became the CEO. Gary Ridge is one of the best learners of leading that I've ever met. An Australian, a kind of no-nonsense, typical Aussie. But he said that he inherited a culture of fear. And it was largely because people hadn't been asked for any new ideas, so they were afraid to make mistakes. And one of the things that Gary had to do when he took over was people would frequently come into his office and say, Gary, I've made a mistake. And he said, no, you haven't. You've had a learning moment. And he would ban the use of failure, the use of that word. And all he asked was that as an employee, you would be willing to share what you learned through that moment of failure. And that helped to transform the company. But he also realized that they had to diversify. So now, actually, although it's not very well known, WD-40 actually have a whole range of products, and they get involved in a ton of things. I think one of the cleverest things that organization did was they suddenly discovered that people were using it for all kinds of purposes. So one of the things that the company's done, which is highly innovative, is to find 1,000 different ways to use WD-40. So even in that context where there's a single product and you think, well, that's probably not a very innovative organization, it is phenomenally innovative. And that's one of the reasons why their levels of productivity keep rising, as does their kind of stock value. Not that I believe that's how you judge a good organization. But it is that making daily progress in meaningful work that I think has been a feature. WD-40's churn rate, you know, the number of employees who leave globally, is about 2%. I mean, it's ridiculously low. And that must say something.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about that particular product and alternative uses to it, because I read recently about one of the founders of Nintendo and how he decided to use, I think it was LCD screens from calculators that I think Sharp made, and decided, how can we use this technology, which had actually become quite cheap, and he decided to make a Game Boy. So taking technology that almost that we've got in our companies, but yeah, Thinking about an alternative use for it, and that kind of diversity of thinking that must kind of encourage those ideas, I assume.
Well, and you're right now into the area of my next book, as you said, which is called We'll Figure It Out. And the subtitle is Mass Ingenuity and the Power of Us. And what you've just described is a phenomenon which has always been around, that people have basically repurposed things that were already in existence. We tend to think of innovation as being creating something brand new from scratch, and in reality that hardly ever happens. What fascinates me, and the reason why I wrote the book, is that we're now in a context where users are innovating, and users are finding ways, as you've just cited an example, where they take something. Let's take the surfboard, for example. When surfers in America, in California, and in Australia found that during the winter months they couldn't really get out onto the water, but they still wanted to practice their moves. And that's how they came to chop down a surfboard, put a pair of roller skates on it, and, of course, that's how the skateboard was invented. So it was users who repurposed existing items, and that is happening all over the world in many, many cases. And when this starts to really hit home right now, is that what we're seeing in terms of people desperately trying to find treatments for this COVID-19 is that there are already existing drugs that have been tested for safety and are now being hastily put through clinical trials for COVID. So this concept of repurposing is actually a key part of what I call ingenuity. The mass part of it comes from, it seems to me, that we have some organizations, take Patagonia, there are some schools, some fantastic schools that I've had the privilege of working with around the world, who are hugely innovative, and they are breeding ingenious students who are constantly solving problems. And what I tried to do in the book was to say, how do we actually develop the culture where this kind of mass ingenuity is just a daily experience? Because my experience of working with organizations in the commercial sector was that they thought that there are a bunch of people who are called creatives, who come up with all the ideas, and that's who you look for in your organization. And then there's the other people who just kind of basically produce stuff. And that's not the case. Everybody's got that potential. What I was constantly being asked to do was go into organizations and make staff more creative. And that seemed to me to be missing the point. The real issue was, we need to create cultures whereby the people will be creative anyway. And I got it down to about 8 key elements that were in common, whether you're talking about education, whether you're talking about Fortune 500 companies, or whether you're talking about NGOs. There were certain characteristics which just kept coming up time and time again that I've kind of highlighted in the book. And I think that's what we should be doing in, not just in the commercial sector, but in our schools, And we shouldn't just be looking at that in terms of what does that mean for our teachers, our employees, but how can we bring about that culture in our students, which is how, you know, I first got interested in project-based learning.
So in terms of kind of collaboration within businesses, and I guess it could be linked to schools as well, you know, there's links there. How do the best companies, the future thinking companies, try and embed an idea of collaboration? I mean, I don't know if we want to go down to the you know, what is the best group size for collaboration, or is it best a collaboration between departments? What's your thoughts of what companies do really well when they're collaborating well, or they've got the culture of collaboration? Have you seen any good practice regards to that?
Oh yeah, heaps of it. I'm going to make an admission. One of the companies that I was fascinated by, I had to declare an interest in, because I actually bought some shares in a craft brewery up in Scotland called Brewdog. You've probably heard of them. And they've been remarkably inventive during this pandemic. And they switched from brewing beer to creating hand gel and sanitizers, because they both got alcohol in their property. But I ended up, because I was a real fan of the company, I ended up going to visit them and talking to the chief executive there, James Watt. And it's astonishing. They are one example, I would say, of these characteristics that these highly innovative organizations have got. And yes, you could look at some of the practical things, and I do this in the book. I talk about what are the practical steps you can make. And yes, you could talk about the size of teams. You can talk about the structure. It generally happens that innovative companies are ones where there's not a big hierarchical structure. And if you think about schools, they are very, very hierarchical. But there are eight kind of key elements. And the way that I can remember these is that they form the kind of acronym of TEAM. So I'll just reel them off, and if any of them appeal to you, we can maybe start to talk about specific examples. But there are the T stands for trust and transparency. The E stands for engagement and equity. The A stands for autonomy and agency. And the M stands for mastery and meaning. And in various permutations and various combinations, the organizations that I've highlighted in the book have got these to varying degrees of strength. But that, it seems to me, is how we actually, we don't have to make people be creative. They will naturally be that if we can create the right kind of culture.
I'm going to change tack slightly in terms of thinking about the way schools can feed into industry and the kind of things that are being kind of discussed in schools in terms of different ways of learning. And I'm thinking of ways of promoting the curriculum in a different way. So project-based learning is one of the big key themes of this podcast series. And I wonder, again, whether you've seen some good examples of project-based learning and what effect it had on the students that you saw engaging in those projects. And you can pick any examples of any schools you've visited across the world.
Gosh, yes. Well, I perhaps I should just preface it by talking about my own experience, which was I started off in the performing arts. I was a professional musician. And when I eventually ended up in education, I was doing projects all the time. You do if you're in the arts. You know, I was putting on concerts. I had students recording music videos, but I didn't think of that as kind of project-based learning. What I realized was that I was kind of just stumbling my way through it. And it wasn't until, let's see, it would be around about 2003, 2004, when I first came across the High Tech High schools in San Diego, who've probably been doing what I would call the project-based learning 2.0, longer than anyone. And I suddenly realized that there was a framework, there was a structure, there was a scaffold. You had all of these things. And my first thought when I saw it in action was to think, gosh, I wish I'd had this when I was a teacher, because there was literally nothing. All that we had, because you asked me about good examples, let's start with the bad examples. In the 80s and 90s, and I think this accounts for one of the reasons why it's been slower to take off in the UK than in other parts of the world. But in the 80s and 90s, I remember project-based learning in schools, and it was kind of formless, and it was very much about, well, let's just let the students do what they want, and they'll come up with the kind of the ideas for the project. What I'm interested in, and I've now trained thousands of teachers all around the world, is in sharing this scaffold, which is quite rigorous, which ensures that students can be working independently, but also securely, because there's no question that this is a different way of learning. It requires students to be working on their own initiative a lot more. So therefore, as the, if you like, the project manager, you as a teacher are in a different role, and you have to be reassured that the students are making the kind of progress and learning the sort of content that you need them to learn. What that means when it's done really, really well is I walked into High Tech High in about 2003, and what I saw, I couldn't believe. I saw students who were creating machines that could create a barcode for the DNA of animals, and they'd just been to Tanzania, where they had taken this and gone around markets which were selling endangered species as bushmeat, and they were testing it with this tool that they'd created. And then they were seeing people being prosecuted for poaching and killing endangered species. Now, when you talk about authentic learning, it doesn't get much more authentic than that. And that was just one example. In those schools, and it doesn't have to be, you know, in developed countries. I've been to a school in Cambodia called the Liga Leadership Academy. And what I saw there were students who were creating economics textbooks for the country. They were on marine conservation projects. They were doing government level work, and certainly undergraduate level work, when they were 15 and 16 year old. So I've seen heaps and heaps of really great practice, which to me goes somewhere towards understanding that there's a global thirst and a global hunger for more project-based learning.
In terms of kind of promoting those kind of future skills, you talk a lot about in your book about the importance of oracy in schools, mm-hmm. And mentioned something called Voice 21. Does that ring any bells?
Yes, indeed.
But could you talk a bit about oracy in schools and tell us about why it's important, and where have you seen it that's been good, and kind of the examples again of what impact it's had on those students?
Sure. Well, Voice 21 is a national campaign to build more oracy in schools. And it's been developed by School 21, which is a really innovative group of schools. They're now across all three sectors, primary, secondary, and they're about to launch their first university. And oracy became important, I think, in that school, partly because they were based in Tower Hamlets. I think there are something like 140 different languages spoken in that particular community. And the people who ran that school, well, Peter Hyman is a great example. He's a former speechwriter for Tony Blair. And Peter recognized that in disadvantaged communities where English perhaps isn't the first language, that ability to present your ideas articulately and confidently is absolutely at a premium, and is separating out the life chances of their kids. So they built oracy as a key part of their platform. And I think where it ties in with project-based learning is that at its best, it seems to me, project-based learning will always have a public audience. I talk about this in my training, and I say to people, you know, a good project, it doesn't just result in a kind of PowerPoint presentation that you show to the senior leadership team of the school, but no one else. It is about bringing parents in to investigate the work, to basically do kind of vivas, you know, university style vivas, which are interrogating what the student knows about that particular concept. And I think that when I've been around these great schools, one of the things that the project-based learning schools have in common is that their students tend to be very relaxed talking to adults. They are confident speaking in public. And they're great at metacognition. They're great at understanding themselves as learners and then being able to describe that to other people. And when you think about that, that's one of the key skills, the ability to present your ideas confidently and articulately. That's one of the key skills that employers are saying they're not getting right now.
Having read parts of your book, I was really interested in the Matthew Moss Academy and Mark Morehouse, who works there, who has got a completely different approach to schooling. And I'll be interested if you could share with us this idea of D6, which I assume is D6. And I assume it's a Saturday program that is run by the school, and what benefits it had in that particular area, which I know is not an affluent area in the north of England.
Absolutely. And in fact, I used to live just around the corner from that school, but at the time I hadn't heard of it. And I've known this school for maybe 10 years. And Mark is a really deep thinker. And he decided that he would set up as an experiment, because we talked about this question of autonomy and agency. I think it's becoming more and more important. If you think about the kind of challenges, this is not going to be the last pandemic. And we've got the climate emergency, we've got all kinds of challenges that our current students in school are going to have to fix, they're going to have to solve over the next 20 to 30 years, then actually agency and autonomy becomes a really important aspect, it seems to me. So Mark decided that purely as an experiment, he would ask what would happen if on a Saturday morning, you just opened up the school to whoever wanted to come. It was purely voluntary. And then you would invite students to essentially do their own learning. There are staff there, but they're not allowed in the classrooms. They essentially just make the tea and coffee. And it started about 5 years ago, and it's still going strong. Well, at least it was until the lockdown. But what happened was that they asked students who'd recently graduated from the high school, who are now at the local further education college, to come in and work as kind of learning mentors. And I was there, I think, on the second week. And what I saw was a completely different approach to learning. So that it was, you know, we talk about a lot of learning is just in case. It seems to me that students are acquiring knowledge or concepts because they might need it for an exam. This was absolutely just-in-time learning, that students would have an immediate problem that they were grappling with, and they would either ask the learning mentors to help them, or they would ask their peers. And so what you see when you're there is this constant movement around the school. It started off with about, I think, 50 or 60 students the first week, and now it's well over a third, getting close to half of the school turn up. What's really fascinating is, given a complete free range of what they could do, most of the students for the past 5 years have chosen for exam revision, which is really interesting that they would decide to do that. But, you know, they're conscientious students. Many of them are from Asian communities and they want to do well in their exams. So they're doing what the students refer to as free learning. But it's beautifully kind of woven into the teacher-directed learning. What's unbelievable about it in one sense, and certainly counterintuitive when I talk to other educators, is that over 5 years, you can imagine there's a huge amount of data that they've assembled there. And what they found is that if a student attends more than seven sessions of D6, so that's only attending seven Saturday mornings of this self-directed learning, peer learning, they will on average get at least a grade higher in their GCSE examinations. If they attend 17 sessions, those students who are taking their GCSEs tend to get a grade and a half better results than the students who don't attend D6. And in a sense, you could say that this is counterintuitive, but for me, the rationale behind it is that we tend to remember more when we're in control of our own learning, when we're directing it. And of course, one of the things that I frequently have to remind educators when I'm working with them is that school is no longer the only place that students are learning. And one of the issues, it seems to me, about the future of learning is that we have to find ways to acknowledge the learning which is going on outside of the school. And we have to find ways to accredit that learning, because our students are doing some remarkable things even when they're not in school.
Yeah, I was thinking, playing devil's advocate slightly in terms of that program, do you think there's an argument to say that those kids were self-selecting, i.e. those were the keen kids who wanted to do that extra learning? Yes, they made the progress, but were there other factors coming into play? And could it all be realistically moved kind of like to the Monday to Friday school, I guess? What are your thoughts on that in terms of the kind of people who turned up and why they turned up?
That's right. And you've just asked the question that I asked the students themselves, because I did a review after a few weeks of this because I was really fascinated by it. And to the question of, why not do this all the time? I actually interviewed a bunch of girls and I said, if this works so well for you, why not do it Monday to Friday? And they said, it was a really mature answer. They said, because there's a limit to the amount of free learning that you can do, which I understand what they mean. Yeah. And what was the first part of the question that you asked?
So I was just thinking about, it's a very successful program, I'm sure it was, in terms of the idea self-selecting, a bit like, say, Oxford University is not great because it just attracts great people. You see what I mean?
Yes, and I'm sure there may well be an element of that. Although I would have to say that when you talk to the students about why they do it, they hardly ever say it's because I'm going to get a grade and a half better. In my account, they tend to say, well, it's because all my friends come here and, it's much more relaxed and we have fun and, it's a social kind of thing. So that tends to suggest that what you get is you certainly don't get the gifted and talented students alone in a school like that.
Okay. It's interesting as well. You talk about in your book about this idea, which I'd not heard of before, called the law of 2 feet. Can you just tell us about what that means to you and, what context that links to?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because a lot of the training that I do, as an adult educator mainly now, I often say to people, listen, we're going to do a few things here, but the law of 2 feet applies, which is the moment you get bored, then you can go off and join another group, or you can look at something else that we're doing. Often we'll separate the learning out so there are two or three things going on at once, and what that speaks to, I think, is there is a societal phenomena which has been going on now for, well, probably since technology really started to make a big impact in our lives, which is that one of the things that the technology's done is allowed us to have much more control over our lives, whether that's, booking our own holidays or whether it's about, sharing videos of cats playing the piano. We are more in control of our lives and thus of our learning than we've ever been before. So if that is the case outside of the formal context, and I include the workplace here now, one of the questions I posed in open is, why would we still be persevering with an antiquated model, which means everybody sits down at the same time and there's a person who stands at the front of the class and talks and then you make notes? That to me seems to be about a model which is no longer being replicated. And one of the challenges that I think that schools have got now is to say that, there is so much engagement through social media and through the technology, and it's real learning that's going on. If I can tap into every single lecture of MIT, which has got some of the finest lecturers in the world, then as a teacher, that's the kind of competition. I can't simply replicate that and stand up and do that. I have to be doing more. And so one of the perhaps controversial things I sometimes say to teachers is that one of the first rules going forward now needs to be, if a teacher can be replaced by a YouTube video, then they should be, that we have to be doing more. But the more part of it is, it seems to me, what the technology can't do, which is to be the kind of the guide for that person. It's also to be the networker, so that if a student is working on a project and you happen to know somebody in the local community who you think they would be really good to bring in on this project, I think increasingly that's going to be part of the teacher's responsibility, and less so the person who's standing at the front doing all the talking. One of the things that inspired the Voice 21 campaign that we talked about earlier is that they did some research in London schools about the amount of time that people were talking in a classroom. And what they found was that in any given hour, the teacher is talking for about 95% of the time. And the average verbal contribution that a student would make in an hour is 4 words. And it seems to me that's got to change. As a teacher, and you're seeing a student who may be struggling with a project, when do you intervene? When do you say, perhaps it would be better if you looked at this? And that's part of that delicate negotiation, I think, and intervention. And far from it being, you know, project-based learning being an easier job for teachers, it's a much more nuanced and much more sophisticated role that they've got. But when it works well, and when students are steaming ahead, you are not the person who's having to think, what am I going to stand up and talk to them about today? Because you don't. They are just getting on with their work. And if you've structured it well, if you've made sure that there are very clear guidelines, very clear milestones, very clear deadlines, then actually it can be much easier when the project's actually in play. And I always say to teachers, the biggest difference between project-based learning and mainstream kind of, you know, direct explicit instruction is that with project-based learning, all your work is front-loaded. If you get your planning right and you get the project structured and set up right, then it gets easier. It feels like a lot of hard work to begin with, but it's just a different kind of weighting of the workload.
Thanks, David. I wanted to circle back just at the end now, reflecting on something I read recently, which links to one of your presentations. And I found it recently that I always knew that the post-it note was the adhesive on a post-it note was a mistake, and they didn't know what to use it for. And they were the chemical company, I think it was 3M, I think it was. The reason why they found a different use for it was because someone linked to the company, I can't remember who exactly, was a choir master, and he was frustrated with the fact that the people in his choir kept all the bookmarks kept on dropping out in his hymn books, and he wanted to find a solution where he could mark the pages, so like a different use for an adhesive that you'd want to put on something and take off, which people hadn't thought of before. But almost like an aside, what I did learn also from your website is something I'd never learned before, actually. Could you just tell us what is the appropriate way to use a post-it note? Because I've been around for 40 years and I didn't know this. Could you share with us the right way to do it?
I wish we had a camera going, because it's much easier to demonstrate this. But yes, essentially, and it's not something that I learned through being in contact with 3M. It was actually another teacher who showed me this. But before I get to explaining that, I think I just wanted to elaborate on the way that you told that story, because it touches a lot of the things that we've been covering in this conversation. So 3M, everybody knows about Google's 15% free time, or 20% it is, where, you know, on a Friday you can essentially work on your own project. So it's self-directed learning. But 3M were doing this way before Google were doing it. They started this in, I think it was 1948. 3M's probably the most innovative company in the world. It has 50,000 product lines, but it has the biggest failure rate of almost any company that I know of. About 50% of its new products never get to market, but it has a tolerance for failure. It realizes that you have to learn through failure. So that's the other thing that we were talking about. But the post-it note, as you described, it was, I think it was a guy called Art Fry who was in the choir. And he in his free time, he decided that he wanted to have this removable hymnal marker. But of course, there wasn't really any kind of market for that. And he couldn't get it to work. It kept falling off. He then passed it on to another friend and said, see what you can do with this. So he used his free time to do this. And the bit of serendipity that happened is, believe it or not, he'd invented the post-it note and had tons of them sitting on his desk, but no one at 3M knew what to do with it. And then one day someone rang and said, could I leave a message for Art Fry? Because he was on his lunch. And the guy who answered the phone said, oh, hold on, I need to find something to write it on. And he wrote it on this post-it notepad and then peeled it off and stuck it on the telephone. And at that moment, they realized what this thing could do. And of course, the thing I always say about the post-it note is that no one ever does a kind of brainstorming session now without the use of post-it notes. It's almost become a cliche. We use it all the time. But it was invented because of people just using their curiosity and mass ingenuity in self-directed learning. So to get to the end point of the story, so I was telling people this story and I had them working on, you know, ideas that they were doing. And I said, put them all up on a post-it note, the usual thing that you do. And then as I put my idea up, someone said, you're doing that wrong. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, that's not how to peel off a post-it note. She said, if you peel off a post-it note from the bottom to the top, and then you stick it on something, and if you've got one at home, you can try this right now. But if you stick it on a piece of paper on the wall, it will curl up. We've all seen this. But if you peel it off left to right and then put it on the wall, it lays flat. I couldn't believe it. I thought they should come with a manual.
They should. Sure should. And I think that's a nice point to end, David, because we're running out of time. But thank you for talking to me this afternoon. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Look out for more episodes coming soon.